is a storyteller, a media producer, and consultant currently working for Southern Oregon PBS, as well as a variety of other media makers. Those who know her often think of her producing abilities with successful arts projects like the Ladies Are Funny Festival, Laugh, from Austin, Texas, Bedpost Confessions, a storytelling show focused on sexuality, relationships, and gender, and Unspoken, a storytelling series focused on different topics such as death, illness, and parenthood. She is a staunch advocate for the LGBTQ community, as well as anything pertaining to sexuality or the body. My guest is Julie Gillis. I'm Aiden Nepom, and this is The Changed Podcast. It's you, Julie. Welcome. You are officially you, and you're here on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's good to see your face.
It's great to see your face. I will fill the listeners in on two fun facts. One, we used to perform together like a decade ago because time is unkind and that it moves quickly forward. And fun fact number two, you live in my hometown where I grew up, where I no longer have any family. I'm no longer attached to Ashland, which is where you are.
Yeah, we did. We performed in musical improv and then in long form narrative improv, doing all kinds of fun things. There's a fun video of us doing Apocalypse.
I will put the promo video for that improv show in the show notes for this, because it is delightful.
And my kids are in it. Both of the boys are in it when they were teenagey, Evan and Owen.
And they're adults now, basically, yeah, both.
They are. Basically. Big monster children. Wonderful boys.
That's pretty wild. You're in Oregon, and you're in Oregon. You are in a hotbed of activism, and you are involved. Do you want to tell me a little bit about your role at PBS and what you've been keeping busy doing?
Sure. We moved here about 4.5 years ago from Austin, Texas, and I am the development director for Southern Oregon PBS, which means I help the station raise money, find major donors, and have support for all of those people who are generous and so kind to give us gifts and support, as well as, I work with we have a small team. So I work with our team on all different kinds of projects and grants and finding ways to tell some local stories for our region. And so that's a pretty exciting job to have. And then I also, I'm a volunteer with a number of organizations down here. One's the Rogue Action Center, and they provide a lot of activism and advocacy around housing and racial justice and LGBTQ justice, and as well as involved with the Planned Parenthood down here in Southwestern Oregon. And, getting up to whatever I can do as a resident, because I'm pretty usually pretty politically active like that.
How has your activism changed over the course of this year? So we're in 2021 now. And as of this recording, we're right in the beginning of 2021, though, you know, as you're listening to this episode, you're probably listening to it in the springtime. But how did you adapt during the course of this? Was it different? Was it the same?
So I was actually having a conversation about this very topic at noon today. So it's really interesting that you asked that question. So I've always used the internet a lot. I'm very much on the internet and was on a lot of social media channels early. So that part actually hasn't changed too dramatically, other than realizing that there are limits, really big limits, to internet activism. But what I've really grappled with in terms of being more isolated and living a much more almost monastic life, food and work and wash the dishes and take care of family, much more almost ritualistic on a daily basis, kind of the very same things, is that there's so much to grapple with. There's mm-hmm. so much upheaval happening, that maybe taking care of family or taking care of self is a role that I wouldn't have actually considered a few years ago. Hmm. Right. So if we look at storytelling and Western storytelling narratives, we have the hero's journey. It's very famous. Joseph Campbell. It's very individualistic. It mm-hmm. assumes you are the hero of any story you're in, as opposed to being a sidekick or a supplementary character, or perhaps even the antagonist, because for everybody's hero, somebody else might be the one in the way. Someone's the villain.
And isn't there that great? There's that great song. I'm blanking on the name of the show, the one where she discovers she's the villain, the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
I can't remember. Yes. But I know you're talking about.
It started out very strong, but there's a whole song in like the second or third season where she discovers that
she's the bad guy.
She's the villain. This whole time she thought she was the hero in the story.
Right. And so because we have a very individualized format that we fit ourselves into, social media is beautiful for that, because you get your own platform, your own tweets, your own Instagram, your own selfies, your own pictures, your own story, your own PR. And that's fun and is certainly addictive because we all do it. What that can mean is when you're isolated and you can't be out in the world, A, how does anybody know you're doing anything? Mm-hmm. And B, what if the most important thing that you could do is chop wood and carrying water, right? What is the most important thing you can do is to feed your family or feed your neighbor, even if nobody knows about it. What if we spend all this time taking care of the world and we forget about taking care of ourselves? You know, I've gone through some medical, 4 surgeries in 2 years, and my body isn't the same as it used to be. My energy level isn't the same as it used to be. So how do I kind of grieve the letting go of like the Julie of 10 years ago when we were doing improv together, and I was in 15 shows and I was raising little kids and I was working full time and also protesting, doing whatever, to the Julie of today that might sit with someone and talk to them. And that is actually more impactful work because of whatever that happened within that quiet conversation.
I'm a deep, deep, deep believer in the value of one-on-one conversations. It seems to me that a lot of what shows up in social media in particular, and I'm sure it shows up in other forms as well, but this sort of like the things that feel good to say or are catchy are not necessarily mind changers, but conversations with people who you have relationships with can be deeply impactful. People see things in a different way when you sit down and you're just like, hey, I love and trust you, but also you just said this thing that totally shocked me. We should talk about it. And they're like, they're like, I didn't want to say anything shocking. What are you talking about? And then you discover something in there.
There's just a lot more question back and forth. And visual cues when you're having a one-on-one conversation, which when you're on Facebook having an argument is more about scoring points, obviously. And I'm totally guilty of that, as I think. I mean
we're all human.
We all.
It's like an endorphin rush when you say something and you're like,
It reminds me though, like when we would do long form improv together, and like Apocalypse, which is the show we were referencing earlier, is like it was a show set in the apocalypse, and every week there was a new hero, an actor playing a hero and an actor playing a villain, but then everybody else was whatever characters. But what improv did, at least for me and how I was learning storytelling, was that we all had to work as a whole unit while realizing we had individual parts. And that the story may not go in the direction you think it's going to go in. And maybe that's better than the direction you thought it was going to go in. And that sometimes there's assigned roles and sometimes there's not. And so that actually really can inform a different way of looking at the world. Like, I wonder what social media might look like if it was less like this, really. Even though it feels broad, I think it really is kind of like my feed versus supporting someone else's feed. I don't know.
There are ways to get a broader snapshot in social media, but you have to actively seek that out, like joining a Facebook group that is specifically identified as other to your perspective. You know, like if you lean one way politically, to join a Facebook group that is the opposite politically, with the goal of understanding their perspective, not of changing all of their minds, because you do, you know, I've seen it work where it's helpful to be informed. And then I've also seen it work the other way, where people show up and they're like, but actually you're all stupid. And here's a meme that proves it or whatever. And then they get booted out of the group. And so it's like, there are ways to broaden your perspective, but you have to really work at it.
Yeah. I think too, like when I was coming of age on the internet, we had more long form dialogue sites like LiveJournal or blogging, posts, and like Medium is a little bit more like that now. Yeah. Twitter is interesting because you can become a main character on the internet if you do something really great or really terrible.
Yeah.
Right. And Facebook sort of can have these group processes, which can be interesting, but it just really depends on the algorithm. I don't know. I'm enthralled with the internet and TikTok and all of the creative, funny ways it can be used. Like, it's genius for comedy. Yeah. But it also can, you know, it can also tell a very particular kind of story. And the way, just to circle back, I think the way that my view of activism has had to change, both because of like aging and having physical, not limitations, but where you're sort of like Galadriel diminishing and going into the west of menopause or middle age or whatever it is. You know, what matters. It doesn't necessarily have to be about like my story. Who else's story could I just be a support for or a chorus for? Right.
I love this idea, Julie. I love that you're thinking about storytelling and how it shows up in these individual streams of interaction. What a cool way to think about the world. It makes me think about, you know, we're raising a little one. She just turned 8 on January 1st. And, so much of what we do is about making her the hero in her own story, which she 100% buys into, that she is the hero in her own story.
Of course.
But it's not a difficult sell. But, but it's like our experience through 2020 was a lot about like making sure that she had a fantabulous year and that she felt smart, successful, entertained, fun, part of unit. You know, like we really thought about her experience a lot
and
trusted that ours would fall into place, and which it did, because you know, as you're pointing out, like there's all these characters that make up a story and when you're in an improv narrative, long form improv show, or the equivalent of a made up on the spot play is another way to think about that. As a player, you really do start to understand the value of playing these support roles and helping to feed the story, the important story, as opposed to the importance of self.
I know. And like, even in an improv show, you might need to take on the character of like the tree in the woods that they have to turn left at.
Right.
And then that changes the whole story. And you were just a tree. You weren't even doing anything. Maybe you drop an apple or whatever. It's funny. But it's like, if you didn't play that tree, then the rest of the story wouldn't happen. You know? Yeah. And so it's super valuable. I think there could be a whole podcast series on like parenting all these different ages through this pandemic, because 8. It's almost like you can create this sort of magic world that she's had to live in, right? But 17 and 21 year olds are grappling with so much difference. And so we're talking, like the 17 year old is thinking about, he's just on the cusp of dating and just on the cusp of like trying to live his social life. And the 21 year old's like, oh, what is this world?
Right.
I should even finish college. you know,
existential angst. Yeah.
But he's like, oh, I don't know, you know. And so it's like you have to try to get them to think about history or think about the beginnings of what service means into a world while honoring that, you know, they don't necessarily always think you know what you're talking about. Because that's like the age too.
Right. They're very like, much in the figure it out for themselves stage of the game.
Right. I mean, yesterday we were like, maybe we should try to get some land and just build a compound, like live completely differently than we thought we would be living. Like,
I have friends who have made that choice.
Yeah. Like, I thought they'd be running off to New York or LA, and they're like, So who knows?
I was like, the timing's not great for it.
Not anymore. Right. So even if you lived in LA, you'd just be in your house. So,
yeah. Yeah, literally I have friends who are like, we're going to buy a piece of property out in the country that is within an hour commute of the city. Mm-hmm. And if we ever need to come into the city again, we'll be able to.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the idea. They're like, but also we're, you know, they're pretty convinced. And I think they're right that there will be, you know, the tendrils of this experience will last longer than the experience itself. And so we will be able to work from home more if people want to, I think.
Yes. I think people have discovered what it feels like to get to take a nap in the afternoon, it's even if they are working. Great. Yeah. Or to start work at 5 in the morning and end at 2 in the afternoon, just because it's, you can. So how are we going to maneuver how we work, where we work, who we work with?
I'm curious, prior to this year, just in a generally broad terms, how would you have classified your thoughts about change and adaptation? What was your own thinking about this broad concept?
I think I learned to turn on a dime pretty early in life, actually. That my dad died when I was almost 9, and he had a heart attack in front of me. And then we moved. And I think that kind of set a stage where I just sort of realized things could sharply turn.
Wow.
And it didn't necessarily turn me into a stubborn, fixed person. And it didn't turn me into an uncommitted person either. I was in theater, and I loved theater because it was always a new thing. Mm-hmm. Right? You have a play, you audition, you get into it, you do the work, you have this experience, it's over, and then you get to do it again. You get to do a new play.
Yeah.
And, you know, I moved to Seattle, and it was all new and all different, a big city. And then story arc is kind of happening. Is that a good time to talk about that story?
Totally.
Arc?
Is this your, are we, this is your story?
We could be in the story. We could, that's why I wanted to check if it was okay to do it.
I am curious before you dive into the story. So sometimes when I ask people to pick a story for this show, to choose one fork in the road moment, they find that to be exceedingly challenging. They're like, I have 30 stories I want to tell. It's really hard to pick one. I'll just figure it out when I get there. I don't know. And other people, when I ask them to pick that story, it's like, they know exactly. Bing! This story. Was it challenging to pick?
No, that I'd say that's that fork in the fork in the road that I'm about to talk about came to my mind very quickly. This moment was kind of a pretty important moment for me, so it came to mind quickly.
Okay, I'm excited.
I'll get
comfy and I'm gonna put my oohs and ahs aside for slightly. And yes, please, if you would tell us a story of this fork in the road moment.
So my husband and I moved to Austin, Texas in 1998, and he was going to graduate school. And I got a job at this wonderful nonprofit that was part of the Austin State Hospital, which was a pretty cool, interesting job to have because we were supporting all of these folks who had mental illness, mental health concerns. It was a good job and I enjoyed it. It was right downtown Hyde Park. And that was all going, I'd say, pretty well, adapting to living in a new place. And I had got pregnant, had a baby, Owen. And I left that job to stay at home with him because I thought romantically at the time that that was sort of what needed to happen. Uh-huh. And that actually was maybe not a good decision because I missed that job a lot and I had to wander a long time before I found another job that I really liked. But then I got a job at UT and I had another baby, Evan. And with Evan, I had really bad postpartum depression. And I don't mean just like the kind of sad for a couple months after you have a baby, but he had colic and he would never slept and I never slept. And my mother was considering, I guess she moved to town. And so it was all just this jamble of like difficult things. And so I wound up in this postpartum depression, which was diagnosed as almost postpartum psychosis. I don't necessarily need your listeners to go down too far of a rabbit hole about postpartum psychosis, but it is a real, it's a real mental health concern because you can think that you should kill yourself. You should think you could kill your child. There is a woman in Houston whose name is escaping me, but this is about 20 something years ago, 20, 30 years ago, killed like six children. You may remember this. She had postpartum psychosis, and after each child, she got worse. And the doctors even had told her not to have any more children, but they did because of their spiritual path. Anyway, so postpartum depression can be marked by being sad. You're really adapting. There's a lot of identity stuff that goes on with being a new parent. Your body is definitely bouncing back. You're estrogen and progesterone balances are realigning themselves. And so it's almost like you've been cut off from a particular drug right after you have this baby. Postpartum depression that gets worse can be marked by insomnia, agitation, hypervigilance, paranoia, and if it gets worse, of course, you can start to, you know, really go into a bad place. And so I was kind of not quite in the bad place, but like flirting with the bad place, I guess, you know. I wasn't sleeping. And I mean, when I say not sleeping, I mean, like I could do two shots of whiskey, take a Benadryl, you know, whatever it was, nothing, right? Wow. And I kind of got to this point where I was like, the idea of hurting myself is rather entertaining. And then I was like, that's not right. And it wasn't. It was not right. And then I went to see my obstetrician, and she was like, okay, yeah, put the baby down. You need to get on some SSRIs. We need to take care of you. And for about a month, I was like, that's not right. I need to be the perfect mother and I need to breastfeed and I need to be like, but I was super hypervigilant. I couldn't unhook. And then I did start taking SSRIs and that was like an almost immediate positive shift.
Wow.
Which I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then in all of that though, at the same time was like this whole, a lot of identity stuff. Like I'm just a mom or I don't have anything in my life that besides the babies and like taking care of bills or whatever that is mine. I hadn't done theater for like 4 years, 5 years, maybe even longer. And my husband and I went to the Hideout and we watched a Star Trekkin', which is an adaptation of Star Trek. Uh-huh. And I was just like, oh, and Chris was like, oh, you could do that. And I was like, could I? And so I signed up for a class at the Hideout and it was, I took the 101, 201, 301, 401 probably. And it was like, I immediately started feeling a connection back to myself. I was downtown, you know, at night, jumping across the street, you know, going out for drinks, having this thing that felt like being, again, like back in my 20s and being creative. And I could do it. I was funny, right? It was a skill set that was like, oh, here I am, swimming again, you know? Like, I remember how to do this. And then that led to being, you know, in a troupe with you and singing, doing musical improv, which was super fun. From there, we all started doing the Ladies Are Funny Festival.
Yeah.
Because we were like, we're funny. Lynn, we're ladies. We should have a festival. And so we did, right? We met all these cool people who were like doing cool things now, you know? And it was like a series of like kind of yes anding into a feeling of being able to be really like powerful is kind of the wrong word, but competent, really competent, which was the opposite of what postpartum depression felt like. We're just feeling isolated or alone in a new city. And, you know, and I made lots of friends throughout that process. And so when we made the decision to move here, I've been able to, I think, employ those skills, right? Like that choice point of deciding, you know, I will go take a class. I will go be reinvigorated and be playful. That was something that has provided me with skills that help me in production. It helps me when I'm, you know, working in a television arena. It helps me, like, literally when I'm doing a live pledge show and I'm staring at my face in a camera and I'm trying to remember what to say next about whatever. But moving here, you know, it was like that was another piece of it was, how do you find new friends? How do you find new playmates? How do you find all your resources? And then when we settled in here, lo and behold, I wound up having to have surgery for, like I had a hysterectomy because I had some structural problems going on. And then the next year I had, what's called a ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a pre-cancer in the breast, which is like a cancer that could turn into something much worse. And I had to have two surgeries actually for that. And, you know, there was a lot of like, how do I yes and those experiences? How do I change with that? I'm not in my 20s anymore. I'm not in my 30s anymore. I'm not really in my 40s anymore. How do I, you know, say, well, where this is happening now, like this is happening now. and that to me is like one of the most important things about the concept of change is that you can fight it. And sometimes fighting it might actually be the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But quite often, like with this pandemic, you've got to be like, well, this is happening. Mm-hmm. I'm working from home. My kid is doing Zoom from home. We are more agitated than we normally would be. This is happening. Okay. It's okay to be depressed for 3 days. It's okay to nap. It's okay to wear the same outfit for 4 days in a row. We don't have to hold to an old way. We can just go. This is what is happening. We cannot stop that thing from happening. We can only change our reactions to it and improv and dance through it. And so that, like that moment back in 2004, I think, was really informative. You know, it gave me skills and it gave me the confidence to move out of a bad emotional situation. And it was just fun, but it also, I mean, it sent me on a trajectory.
Yes. Oh, I mean, it sounds like an entire journey to present day was sparked by going to see Star Trekkin', which is pretty.
I think Kevin Miller was in that show. Thank you, Kevin Miller.
Sean was in that show.
Yeah, and Andy Crouch.
Shana,
yeah, probably.
Was,
I mean,
probably in that show.
Yeah,
David,
I mean, everybody
was in that show, I think.
Oh, more than likely. Yeah, and like,
because back then I think he was in every show.
Yeah, I just think, yeah, I think what's been interesting living here in Ashland is that it is a tiny town.
It is.
It's not the tiniest town. It's not like Northern Exposure tiny.
Well, it was when I was a kid. It was a population of 12,000, but
it's like 20,000, 19,000. Yeah. But it is really different. Northwest is different than Southwest. Small town is different than really big urban city.
Yeah.
And we don't have like 5 improv theaters doing different shows that you can kind of get involved with.
Right.
You know, and I don't have the energy for that necessarily anyway. I've had to redefine again.
You've been through like change after change after change after change. And when I hear you talking about, the improv mindset, that the gift that you were given to help you shift gears at this low point, do you ever feel like sometimes it's too much adapting? I don't know if that's the right question, but it's a thought that I have occasionally that there's a balance to be struck. Change is going to keep happening. It's going to happen at whatever pace it's happening. You can be the spark behind it, or you can be the receiver of what's happening. I don't know what the alternative would be. You could be like, I'm going to put the brakes on. Like, I will not get surgery. Thank you. I'll just say I'm totally, everything's fine. Like,
I don't know. So like, let's talk about the really consistent parts of my life. Because I'm an actor at heart, people might see more of that, the narrative dramatics. And I don't even think I'm that dramatic on Facebook, but I might tell you my story and that's going to involve a thing. But I don't say, you know, Chris and I have been married for like 25 years, together for 27, you know, I do say that. I do. I mean, I point it out on the internet, but like, that's a very consistent piece of my life. I have a great relationship with my mother-in-law and my father-in-law who live here, and you know, they've been in their same home for this whole time. And so there's roots and connection there. And I've been a performer since I was a young person. So that hasn't changed. And I have these children in my life that, you know, one's almost 21 years old. So that's a rich, solid line. And like I was saying, one of the things this year has been for me is it's a very monastic, consistent.
Right.
Day in, you know, get up, go from the bed to the kitchen to the office to the, you know, to make your own lunch, to clean your own lunch, to get with the kid. It's like, don't go out. We're not going out. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas when I was, you know, when we were in Austin, like, meet you for lunch, go downtown, do this, like your life would have been like zip, zap, zip, zip all over the map. Like my map movements are like,
I reflect back on life as a performer in my 30s and I'm stunned at how much activity there was and how little downtime. But there wasn't no downtime. It's like stunning. My brain can't even fathom what that life was like because I had work that I did. Mm-hmm. I had sewing projects that I did. Mm-hmm. I also was meeting people out and teaching classes and going out for drinks and I cannot fathom how it was possible to drive around that town back and forth as I did as well. Like this is what I mean by time feels so strange to me. You know, these days I'll wake up when I feel like it, which is great. And then I get my coffee and then I go to sit down at my desk and it's been 2 hours and I went literally nowhere.
Yeah.
But my kitchen. Yeah. What is that?
I could leave my house in Windsor Park to go to a bedpost show and it could take me 40 minutes to drive 2 miles. Right.
Yeah.
Because of whatever it was, the traffic and how many people, the density. And so, I mean, just, I guess in answer to that question, there has been a lot of change. Like I am I've had some mercurial aspects to my life, but I do think there are grounded pieces. Like I have some consistencies. Like I've always done performing. I've always really been focused on how performing works with community, right? So the storytelling that I've done, the Ladies Are Funny Festival is a great example. It wasn't enough just to be like, I'm doing a show twice a week. It was like, let's have these women do this thing. And like, I was always really proud. It wasn't a big festival. It wasn't like huge. It was 6 years worth, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a South by Southwest situation, but you know, there were some really like Holly Lorca, incredible performer who's written a book now after doing that, plus Bedpost and
Selena Kopic, who's got a great podcast if you're into scented candles.
She's just so funny and beautiful. And Lauren Lapkus and Sarah Benincasa and just all these really great people who are in the world. And Aparna Mancharla, you know, Carrie Lendo, who was a producer for a really long time and was just like really just lovely people doing lovely things. And so that actually is very meaningful to me, and to have little pot and Bedpost is full of people like that. And I'm working with a whole lot of really amazing activists, not so much artists here right now, but activists, and they're just doing really good work. And so community is a consistent piece, even though there's change around it, right? There's maybe a new setting or a new format. But
your sense of community and activism was really has always been such a big part of you from my experience of you. And I don't know if you know this, you probably know this, but the Ladies Are Funny Festival and my relationship with it changed my understanding of feminism. Conversations with you about the festival changed my understanding of feminism and how I identified. Because when I first auditioned to be part of this improv group with you that you were already in, and that was already producing this festival that I didn't know about, and I got cast, and then we had rehearsal, and then like within a month or something, there was this like, let's sit down and talk about the festival, and we'll have some initial planning meetings. And I was like, whoop, 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 whoop. I auditioned to be part of a performance group, not a festival planning committee.
That's one of them highfalutin activist situations. Sorry.
And you were like, this is work that matters, and this is what this troupe is about. And I was like, hang on. But it's a women in comedy festival. Like, do we even need that? That was my feeling at that time.
There were a lot of ladies who said that, as I recall, on many a thread on the Austin Improv Forum that were heated.
Back to when which forums I say, were how we talk to each other.
Oh my goodness gracious.
I did not have a concept of a need for feminism. I was like, we already solved this. This is solved. Aiden, feel great in the world that I live in. Gender is not an issue for me. And so therefore, it is not an issue for anybody, right? Hero in my own story. Right. I was like, I don't have problems advocating for myself and nobody treats me terribly and I would never get hurt and everything is fine. So why do we need a comedy festival? And and it was the conversations with you and with Mo, who also was a guest on this show.
Yes, she was.
And who you still maintain a close friendship with.
I do.
But it was the conversations with you that totally changed my perspective on the value of something like that and how important it can be, and the evidence for it being people's negative reactions to its existence.
That was
a particularly impactful observation to share with me. And then once that first festival that I was part of took place and I saw the talent that showed up for this festival and sitting in the audience and hearing the conversations that happened as a result, I was like, I get it.
Thank you for sharing that with me. It's really kind for you to share that with me. One thing yes anding gets you is when someone calls you in to say, okay, but what about You go, instead of saying, but we can't include these people because the poster won't work. You say, right. Oh my gosh, let's make a new poster. Let's actually sit with people and be like, oh gosh, I was actually leaving you out. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Right. And that to me is, that can be the joy of like utilizing improv, and you've seen this because you do work in corporations or work, you know, doing any kind of work with a group where a group system can get stuck. We've always done it like this. This is the mythos and the story and the narrative. And you can be like, but, and, you know, yes. And you can add a new chapter. Mm-hmm. You can try something a little bit different. And even if it doesn't work, you can also do it the old way again.
You know, it's been really interesting because of the work that I do. I have clients on all sides of the political spectrum, and I'd like to keep it that way because I enjoy hearing these differing views. But what I hear as a result is all these different places where change feels like a sticking point, and it isn't always about life moves.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's like sometimes it's about somebody else's life moves feel sticky to me because I have to change something.
Oh, gosh. That we just had a family meeting yesterday about some things which are too mundane to be interesting right now. But, you know, Owen was like, well, why don't we do X? And Evan and I went, and then Owen was like, I think that's worth examining based on your reaction.
Right?
I was like, raised damn by it. You. Damn it. But, you know. And I was like, I'll examine it, but I don't think I'll change my mind.
But will you change your mind?
Well, it may be part of it had to do, it had a lot to do with values about how we're dealing with our time during this pandemic. And so part of me was like, I don't want us to go around policing how we spend the time that we have to spend in this house. Like if you want to take 3 showers a day and I want to chop wood for an hour, like I think we're just gonna let that be okay. Those weren't the topics, but that was like there was that mundane, but yet it evoked a response. But the response was more about like, I have so little during this pandemic. Don't make me change what comforts me. You know,
that's totally fair.
Don't make me change what comforts me. So I did think about it. I mean, I did examine it. Like, he's a smart kid, a smart young man. And, but yeah, that is actually the thing. It isn't necessarily like a life change that will get to me. It'll be like, some value or.
I found when it comes to, that place where things feel sticky, somebody else's big changes feel sticky to me because I have to change something small. I've found that for me, I just have to sit with my discomfort on that. Like, I think of many times when I discovered life worked in a different way than what I thought, or somebody had a relationship I didn't know about, or, any of these sort of things that are like, they're not about me.
I mean, I think that you're correct about these small things. And I do think that they can have to do with your own individual story, but those also then those go into beliefs and value systems, right? So fantasizing about dating to getting married versus dating to never getting married.
Yeah, dating to date.
Or when you have a friend and then you find out that they voted for a candidate that you abhor, and you're like, and you have a cognitive dissonance moment because now you've invested story time and love and affection and time with this person. But here's a nugget of something that doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. So how do you work with that? Do you mention it? Do you talk about it? Do you break up your friendship? Do you justify it? You know, because we've created all of these meanings. And so the change part can feel stuck, or there can be, you know, cognitive dissonance is a big one.
Oh, it's a huge one. Cognitive dissonance gets in the way of a lot of acceptance because people's mm-hmm. discomfort is overwhelming.
Yes.
Julie, I love talking with you.
I love talking with you too. It's a pleasure.
I love having you here. To leave people with some final thoughts, what mm-hmm. is it that you would love to, I mean, you're on a podcast. What do you want people to know?
What do I want people to know? I want people to really think about what community means. Mm. I want people to think about, and you know, what a sharing culture looks like, what it means to be a sharing community or an individualistic community, because people may have very good reasons for not wanting to do a thing or to do a thing, but you know, how do we treat each other better through the process of keeping each other safe and healthy?
You know. Thank you so much for sharing all of your thoughts on change, on community, on adapting, and your journey with improv. I think, you know, we don't talk about postpartum depression enough in this country. So I appreciate you sharing all of those things.
All of the hormonal situations we don't talk about. Hormones are magic. They can be angels or demons. And we don't, it's true for any friend I've had who's transitioned is the whole thing about hormones. We should have a hormone podcast. Anyway, but yes, menopause, postpartum depression, any of it, puberty.
It's
hard.
I don't know why it's such a secret all the time when so many people go through it.
Everybody goes through at least one of them.
Yep.
I love you, Aiden.
Love you too. I really like this idea that Julie brought up, this relationship between storytelling and how we view ourselves in relationship to our work, our communities, and to simply filtering through the events that we experience in life. In fact, I often advocate to my clients that they make themselves the hero in their own story, which can be particularly helpful when interviewing for jobs, when self-promoting or marketing, and of course, when just trying to figure out what it is you care about most in life. However, as Julie points out, there is plenty of room in life to explore what it means to play supporting roles, to play other characters in somebody else's story, to recognize when you've become the antagonist to somebody else's hero. I think this is a particularly important idea to explore as a leader, particularly if you're interested in collaborative leadership, because what would you rather, to have everything hanging on your personal success or failure, or instead to look for opportunities to play that important supporting role for the members of your team so that they can rise and become the heroes in their stories, in turn supporting the longevity and success of your business, which becomes a story in and of itself. As in all matters of communication, with storytelling, a little goes a long way. So I'm sure there'll be opportunity in your life and mine to tell many kinds of stories. I want to hear from you. Have thoughts, feelings, sarcastic remarks, or a story to share based on listening to this episode? Help me keep the conversation going. Join the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/changehub. Thank you to Julie for her stories and thoughts. Special thanks go to my family for their love, support, and patience. To all of the amazing Changed Podcast Patreon page members who I couldn't do this without. The Art of Change Skills for Life, and Patreon member producer, Dr. Rick Kirshner. Thank you to you for listening to the Change Podcast. I'm Aiden Nipom, and I wish you the kind of experiences in life you're excited to tell stories about.